doing this. They said when you got here, the whole thing started. I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil. Evil!
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
I'll follow you through.
Swallow this.
The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
Have you ever heard Candyman?
You moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you?
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
You don't know what death is.
This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation.
Messenger of God, you do we can stay here.
God is dead!
Satan lives!
Oh, it's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
The animals are contagious! What? What?
It's time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Secretary, the missiles are flying.
See me in hell, Mr. Thorne. Hell will shout out our sentences.
I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies.
It's still a procedure. It's called making a head on a stick.
I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
There is no one watching out for us, Merrill. We are all on our own.
And there's no more room in hell for the dead who walk here.
The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Something in the middle! Shut the door, my God! You gotta tell them! Silent Green is people!
You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent. We usually have a fifth co-host, however, he screwed up dates and times, and so he will not be able to join us tonight. Before we get into any of that, I guess we can discuss who we are. We're a Dark Discussions podcast, basically a podcast that comes out weekly to discuss a genre film mostly, sometimes TV shows and a few other things, but basically sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, cult films, and horror films. We try to discuss and critique intelligently a genre that deserves intelligence. Any news anybody wants to, we'll do house cleaning near the end, except we'll talk about one house cleaning thing. Let's talk about that. No, we're going to do that after the news, because the one house cleaning thing is directly related to tonight's subject. So any news anybody want to bring up? Anything of note?
No.
Mike, you saw Captain Marvel. What was your opinion and so forth? Any little feedback?
I wasn't a big fan. I didn't particularly care for Brie Larson in the role. She had a lot of the film. She was fine until she had to give serious dramatic line readings, and then sometimes it was pretty. There was some of it was pretty bad, but I also had, in all fairness, a really annoying family sitting behind me throughout the film, and that may have taken me out of the movie when I should have been more invested in it.
Did
you murder them?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
So it was just okay in your opinion. It wasn't one of the stronger Marvel films out of a lot of the Marvel films that have been released.
Not in mine, but I know a lot of people who
just ask
are liking it. So,
yeah. Okay, but
and again,
but,
I had an irritating issue because I had a family that never taught their children theater etiquette.
Gotcha. All right, so lukewarm, but still worth seeing.
Maybe. Depends on how big you are. Like, if someone's not a fan of Marvel movies, I don't think this is going to swing them around. If someone is a fan, they're probably going to go see it anyway.
Gotcha. All right, sounds good. Also, for folks who have not seen or listened to Searching for American Gods, American Gods podcast, Mike, what was your opinion of the first episode of that TV show for people who don't listen to that podcast that we do?
I liked it. I think it did have a different vibe than what we had last season, but it's, you know, too early to say what the effect of behind-the-scenes changes is going to have long-term. It's only an eight-episode series, and we'll be doing seven more, so... Yeah. Hop on board if you have access to the Stars Network or to the TV series American Gods. I don't know what its availability is outside the U.S. You know, like if it's on Stars worldwide, or is that just a U.S. thing? Is it carried by, I don't know, Netflix or something? I have no clue. But if you're interested in listening, you know, please join us every. We're doing every Monday, right? So.
Yep. We record Monday, try to get it out by Tuesday, no later than Wednesday, the episodes. But yeah, I felt it was pretty good begin to season two. Let's see. Greta, that horror movie just came out, or thriller just came out about a week and a half ago, so this second week in a row it was at the theaters. Anybody have seen that one yet?
I'm sorry, what's the title?
Greta.
Greta.
Oh,
like the girl's name.
No, I heard somebody talk about that, but I wasn't... Is that in theaters?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I was looking for it on streaming services. So, no, it's not in a theater near me, and I've not had a chance to see it.
Gotcha.
It got a lukewarm review from David Chen on Slash Filmcast.
Yeah, it's about 54% on Rotten Tomatoes, so, you know, half the people liked it, half the people did not. Any other... genre TV shows or films, whether VOD or not, anybody wanted to discuss?
Real quick, I watched a movie from 1980. If I'd seen it before, I don't remember seeing it before. It's called The Final Countdown. I was very disappointed that it actually does not have a soundtrack by Europe, but it does star Martin Sheen, and... it's about an aircraft carrier that gets sucked into a time travel vortex and ends up in the Pacific Ocean on December 7th, 1941. And, of course, you get all sorts of ethical discussions about whether or not they should try and stop the Pearl Harbor attack. So if you're into that kind of thing, it's worth it.
Ooh, that sounds good. What's the name of that?
The Final Countdown.
Where can people find that, Eric?
I found it on one of the streaming services. I'll be honest, I can't remember which one.
Wait a minute, is that an older movie?
1980.
I was going to say, I think I've seen that. That one and the Philadelphia Experiment were both kind of out around the same time.
They have
time.
A similar cover art, too.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right, but I'm going to rewatch that because that sounds like fun. I know I've seen that. You know what? I might even own it. I'll have to go down to the basement and look.
There you go.
And then I revisited another movie, which is actually a personal favorite of mine. This is probably like the 10th time I've watched this movie. It's Falling Down, starring Michael Douglas, which isn't necessarily a genre or horror film.
It's a thriller.
But it's a really dark drama. You know, when I think of this movie, I generally remember... one of the three or four points in the movie that are laugh out loud funny. But watching it again this time, I realized just how dark the movie is, and how still completely relevant it is today, even though it was made in 1993. So if you haven't seen it for any reason, Falling Down with Michael Douglas is a really good dark drama.
That was when Michael Douglas was one of the leading actors in Hollywood, as a matter of fact.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and you've always liked that film. You've actually even suggested it as an episode a couple of times, and I think we put it up on one of our...
Polls,
yeah.
But
yeah.
It lost.
It did.
Yeah, if you have kids, it's a perfect movie. If you're one of those people who, you know, for some reason ever just wanted to throttle the shit out of a random person.
Because they're stupid.
Maybe
yeah,
every
that's,
day.
That's
mad
that might,
as
that's
hell.
A movie that might have an appeal to you.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
That's yeah, but at the same time, there's the moment at the end of the movie where Michael Douglas delivers the line, "I'm the bad guy?" And that seemed
that's
particularly
yep,
poignant
yep.
to me this time around.
Yep, yep. That's an excellent point. Excellent point, because sometimes one man's terrorist is another man's.
Let's not go here again. It's not the case.
Well, let me rephrase.
Let's talk about it some other time if we do an episode.
Yeah, yeah. But Mike is concerned that we're going in places that don't work.
Dark crevices.
Yes, we will move on. Donnie Darko is a hero. on a side note, let's see. Is there any other things that anybody wanted to bring up? I wish I could.
There's one thing I did want to mention. I texted Phil a picture earlier. I thought about him earlier today when I pulled up behind the Jeep at the stoplight and noticed two bumper stickers on it. One of it says, "Use your blinker," and the other one says, "Bumper sticker."
Right, and there was actually another bumper sticker that said Boston.
Yes, yes, and all those are spelled A-H.
Yes.
Yeah, Blinka, Bumpa, and Sticka are all spelled with A-H, so
yeah,
I couldn't help but think of Philip when I saw that.
Just have a stroke now or something, that was actually
Well, that's the thing, is that people have made this mistake throughout the United States and England and Australia and everywhere else, that the letter A is pronounced R when it's actually pronounced.
That's actually how it's pronounced. You just can't speak English correctly.
Wait a minute. So let me ask you a question, Phil.
Yeah.
I know you like watching sports ball every now and then. Is there a particular New England sports team that you happen to enjoy watching?
yes, two of them. Generally, the Boston Red Sox and the New England Patriots would be the two.
Not
including minor league hockey or.
What is that Soxy team again?
The Red Sox.
Red Sox.
Yeah, yeah, but you got to understand, English is an interesting language. Certain letters. when it's like the French, when certain letters are at the end of the word, you don't pronounce them like Bordeaux. It wouldn't be Bordeaux.
You need to give up this one, Phil.
Yeah, it's just a. What do you get? It's a regional.
Use your blinker.
Exactly. Blinka. That's correct. It's lobster, not lobster.
Yeah.
Lobster.
Well, it's like it's going down a rabbit hole. I'm sorry, but I was reading something. I don't know why I was reading something about language. And originally, if you went back like 200, 300 years ago, nobody would pronounce their G's at the end of words in English.
Hmm.
So if you were a well-refined, educated person, you're still going hunting, fishing, you know, and it was later they started pronouncing the G's. So actually the people who sound like rednecks are pronouncing things the way they were supposed to be.
Well,
it's okay when he goes down a rabbit hole. It's not okay when we do it.
Right, exactly. It's a double standard. You know that.
Yeah. No, it has nothing to do with it. It was the particular rabbit hole Phil was going down because we've had this argument before.
Donnie Darko. Is a true
Donnie Darko.
Donnie Darko is a true hero, and that's that, Mike. And I don't
hero.
That's right. That's right.
That's
right. But what they believe happened was the original folks that landed in Boston were from a part of England that this dialect comes from. Okay, I guess that was it for news and some boring stuff about language and double standards by Mike. But we can move on.
No,
I guess,
double standard.
With our topic. But before we do have some house cleaning. And it's something about Patreon. Eric, what is Patreon?
Patreon is an online service that allows you to donate to your artists to support them. Producing this podcast is not free. We have to pay for stuff like hosting servers and new equipment and things like that. So if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or just follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com For every $5 a month you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all the submissions and draw them on a quarterly basis. For more details, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
That's right, that's right. And tonight's topic is one of those Patreon winners, and I think it was Sean Fox of Canada, or Gage Fultz, but I think it's Sean Fox. He chose the film tonight. I don't have the spreadsheet open, so I can't verify it. But, yeah, so you donate to our podcast, we will possibly pick your film that you choose for us to review. So anybody who donates, we greatly appreciate it. We don't have too many people who donate, so the chance your film will be picked is highly likely. So I think that's pretty much all we got. So Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
We're going to be discussing the 1994 film The Crow, starring Brandon Lee.
People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, the crow could bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
That gasoline I smell?
Victims, aren't we all?
That's right, 25-year anniversary of the film, The Crow, starring Brandon Lee. Brandon Lee, the son of a famous actress, I believe, as well, but he's really known for the son of Bruce Lee. Roger Ebert stated that this film was probably better than any of Bruce Lee's films, which was highly recommended by Roger Ebert. Directed by Alex Proyas. Alex Proyas is one of those interesting directors that put some damn good films out, and a couple of lemons too, but his most famous film, or the film that he will probably be remembered for besides this film, is Dark City, which was arguably a classic. But he said hasn't really directed many films, which is kind of odd. Film also stars some international cast, actually. For example, Michael Wincott, Canadian actor. People know who he is. Brandon Lee and Ernie Hudson are Americans, as people know.
Who is Michael Wincott? Because he's one of those guys. He's a character actor who's you would know his face. I don't know that he's somebody a lot of people know by name.
That's true. He plays villains usually, though. He played the Doors manager in the movie The Doors, but he was also in another Patreon pick, Dead Man. He played one of the actors in that. Yeah, he's definitely not anybody like household name, but if you see him, you know him. But I think his most interesting thing is his facial features and his voice. He's a pretty good actor, generally. Also, Bei Ling is in this. Bei Ling is a fairly popular actress from the Asian continent. I believe
goodness, does Phil not know what country she's from?
Well, I was
finally came.
No, she's from China, but the question is she's Hong Kong Chinese or mainland China? You have to determine whether or not she's Cantonese or Mandarin. And I am not quite sure, but my guess is that she is Mandarin because she is from China itself. However, many of her work is from Hong Kong.
I hope you're happy with yourself, Eric Webster.
Yeah. Well, and you know what else, Phil? You have broken the hearts of all of our listeners tonight.
She's technically Chinese, but she's a Hong Kong actress.
Look, I know Phil was just trying not to alienate the Chinese market by pigeonholing her. I had faith that he was aware that she was Chinese. I mean, it's Bei Ling. What else is it going to be?
Yeah, and she's fairly well known for genre cinema for, like, she's close to 50 now. Do we consider her a Hong Kong actress, or do we consider her Chinese? But either way, Mike is right. Doc Discussions is planning a move into China. That's a huge market for us.
It is a huge market, yes, for podcast.
I'm sure, though we've been blocked by Google over there, as most things are. So forget about it.
Blocked a few places in the U.S. too, but...
What are you going to do? But anyway, that's pretty much the cast. Is a bunch of other people that no one knows. Though the woman that played the prostitute that got caught up in The Unforgiven
has another well-known name.
Has a huge
Phil.
And who's that?
Tony Todd.
I didn't see him.
He was the big black guy.
That was him. Well, the glasses?
Yeah, the accountant or whatever he was.
Okay. I did not notice. He was so young.
He was very young in this movie, yes.
Wow. Just like in Apocalypse Now, the black guy on the boat that drives the boat, it was the guy from The Matrix, and he looks completely different because he's a little young thing.
Lawrence Fishburne.
Fishburne. He's like 18 in Apocalypse Now.
Yes,
and
he was also very...
Yeah, so completely different. So I didn't know that either. But, I did not notice that was Tony Todd. How about that? Thank you for bringing that. So that's pretty much all we got there. I guess we can discuss how we heard about this film, our experiences in the past, because it probably isn't the first time any of us have seen the film. Maybe, maybe not. But let's start with you, Mike.
Yeah, I saw this in theaters. You know, I'm a comic book nerd. This is based on a Dark Horse comic. I never read the comic, but, you know, this goes back to, if you can imagine it, a long, long time ago when you could go to a movie on a weekend and there wasn't a comic book movie in the theaters. And I would generally try to support my comic book films because I had this weird dream that hopefully one day they could actually get characters like, I don't know, you know, Spider-Man or Thor or, you know, into theaters and make good movies. But they were all kind of scrambling after Batman had been a huge hit in 89. And so everyone was trying that, but whoever had, like, the rights to some small comic book property would do it. And you ended up getting movies like this, or The Mask was another one, or Judge Dredd, and getting made.
Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula by Coppola had that kind of feel with the old...
Yeah, but it wasn't an actual comic book property, you know.
That's true.
I mean,
there's stuff like
Tank Girl was another one. So anyway, so I saw that. I really loved the film back then. It was this Doc and Moody story. The visuals were really, really good. It's a very, very slight tale, you know. It's a very much a style over substance story. I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. It's just, you know, not a deep story. It's just a very basic revenge flick for in a lot of ways, and so I enjoyed it a lot. And I haven't seen it in about 10 years, and I think the last time I watched it, it had also been a while since I had seen it. And the last time I watched it, for whatever reason, and it could have just been catching me in a wrong mood, I was kind of bored by it, I think, if I remember correctly. And so I was a little concerned about rewatching it tonight. Not tonight, but last night when I did. But no, I found I was kind of pulled back in and dug it. And I kind of dug just looking at, this was a low-budget film. You know, it was like a $20 million film. But all the like, how much practical effects there were, that they built this little miniature city. All of this stuff would have just been done digitally. And I thought it was surprising how much, and maybe it was just me, that, you know, visually, because of the long coat and the scraggly hair with the white makeup, how much Brandon Lee reminded me of Heath Ledger's Joker in parts of this film.
Yes.
You got there first. I was going to point that out.
So, yeah, so I, like I said, I had fun with it. And if you're looking for a darker, quote-unquote, superhero movie, that's not exactly a superhero movie, give it a try.
Now, Mike, is it a cult classic or a classic or some sort of...
Oh, because like it was a hit when it came out. It was like... I was reading up on it. It was something like 24th in the box office for 1994. You know, so it wasn't like a mega hit like Batman had been. But it was certainly successful. It made like $50 million on a $25 million budget. So, and that was domestic. You know, who knows what it made internationally. Because we didn't pay attention to those markets back then. I don't know how well remembered it is. I do know I had a student ask me, because he's annoying, but asked me, you know, what I was doing last night, and I said I had to go watch a movie, and they said, and I said, what movie? And I said The Crow, and my little Hot Topic girl kind of perked up when she heard I was watching The Crow.
Still yeah, so hit with a goth crowd today.
Wow, my teacher's actually cool, not a dork.
Yeah, yep.
And then there was like, well, somebody didn't know what the movie was, and I said, well, it's an old superhero movie, sort of, but not really, you know. But anyway, so yeah, so there is that segment, right? You got the, you know, this is that era where the formative years for the Hot Topic crowd, because you had The Crow come out,
the grunge music was coming out.
What was that? Yeah, grunge music, and the next year you were going to get Nightmare Before Christmas, you know. So. But yeah, this is very much Hot Topic, the movie. You know, this is the whole emo aesthetics. You know, comes right here. You know, but
all right. Very good. Thank you, Mike. Chrissy.
I have never seen this. When I went to see Batman in 1989, which was obviously a very big, huge hit, I was a senior in high school, and I know that all of my friends who were comic book geeks at the time were really thrilled with Batman, and I saw Batman and kind of went, okay, this really is not for me. So it was just, at that point in my life, it was just dark, and it was just something I wasn't into. So when The Crow came around in 1994, I remember seeing I was 23 when this movie came out. I remember seeing the ads and going, oh, that looks like another Batman kind of a thing, and I'm probably not going to like it. So I didn't bother going. The good news is I am really glad that I waited until now to see it, because I think I appreciated this. I just fell in love with this. And I think all of my years of studying symbolism and things like that, and all of my years of just being experienced with seeing all these different movies I had never gotten to see when I was a teenager and a young adult, I just have such a much stronger appreciation and affinity for this stuff. And I do think that when I was 23, yes, I probably would have gone to theater and been like, well, this is crap, and I wasn't interested in this. So I really fell in love with this movie. I was really impressed with it. I think it ages well. And the only reason I can kind of say that is because I'm sort of remembering, like, I watched this and went, this really doesn't feel like 1994 to me. Like, I was like, this feels like it could have just come out a couple of years ago. I'd never seen Brandon Lee in anything, and all I have to say is that it's really sad that we lost him so young, because I think he would have been one of the bigger male actors of our generation, of my generation. I loved the noir atmosphere. I loved the scoring. Which was both, it was an interesting mix of like the grunge that was really hitting its height at that time. Grunge music in like, I want to say 90, like late 92 to like 95, 96. For me, that's when grunge was really hot. And also the score also had some Native American elements in it, certain drum beats, certain instruments that I thought was interesting. And there were a few, you know, jazz references, which are kind of a hallmark of noir films. So I thought that was really cool. I thought the story was solid. I appreciated that this guy was back for revenge, but that he wasn't all just balls on angry. The character had emotional shading, and that was kind of interesting to watch. I enjoyed the mystical elements and the fact that the mystical and the supernatural elements were there, but they were subtle. And the character arc really worked. So, I mean, all in all, I had a lot to like about this movie. And it did seem to get a lot of hype at the time and then over the years. And I often wonder about films the same way I wonder about books. When you get a lot of hype, in my experience, when somebody hypes a film or a book to me, and I'm talking about people that maybe don't watch a lot of horror movies or don't read a lot of horror books, and they come, or these types of things, and they come and they're like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen. What I usually say is, okay, it's probably at best average or mediocre. And at its worst, it's probably terrible, but it's usually never great. And then you have the whole jumping on the bandwagon thing, which is kind of what I always assumed the appreciation for this movie was about. And I was wrong. I think this movie really deserved the hype that it got. I think it was certainly different for its time as well. So that's my thoughts on it. And I'm really glad that I got a chance to watch this. And now I'm going to be looking for special editions or things with features on it, because I really kind of want to watch this again. I just really liked it.
All right. Very good. I bought the disc about 12 years ago, because that was when I started saying, all right, I got to stop seeing all these genre films that everybody has seen that I haven't bothered seeing. And so there was a special edition, couple of discs. So I have the DVD, but I just decided to watch it on Netflix and didn't pull out the DVD because it's right now on Netflix. But I had watched it back 12 years ago, 11 years ago, and I remember that I didn't really enjoy it that much. It was okay. I guess I was expecting it to be different than what it was based off of the hype. So last night I decided to watch it again for this episode, and I immediately texted Eric saying, at like 8:30, I texted him saying, I have to stop watching The Office for some crappy film at 9 PM. And, Eric obviously said I had a problem because I watched Office too much, but, so I watched it, and it's awesome. This film, it rules. I was shocked how much I would enjoy it a second time watch 11 years later. Brandon Lee is incredible. I agree with Chrissy. He would be 53 today. And so he would have definitely been a force in Hollywood for at least a few years anyway. And his passing is unfortunate. We'll discuss his passing because it happened during this film, as well as the distribution of the film because of it. It was a solid genre film, really good. And yeah, I mean, as a period piece from 1994 and grunge and emo and goth and all that stuff, I guess it's there. I didn't look at it that way because I was just watching the film. And so I didn't really put it in perspective of the year it came out and the culture around the time when it did come out. But just as a film, a genre film, it's really good. And Brandon Lee was incredible in this role. Big thumbs up. Eric?
I guess I'm going to be the odd man out on this episode. Mike was saying how he remembers the last time he watched that, he was kind of bored. That's the experience I had this time. It was occurring to me while I was watching this movie that it actually has a very similar story to the 1986 film The Wraith, starring Charlie Sheen, with somebody coming back for vengeance and even having a character named Skank. The 90s CGI, for some reason, was really, really bothering me on this latest watch.
What CGI?
There's a bunch of it that stands out during the scenes when they're falling out of windows and things like that.
I think those were just optical effects. I don't think that was CGI.
Yeah, well, whatever it was, it didn't look great. And I thought Brandon Lee was fine in the movie. I don't think it was bad. And I did notice the same thing Mike did. There's a scene where the crow comes into the room with a room full of bad guys and just kind of sits down on the table cross-legged, very reminiscent of the scene from The Dark Knight when the Joker comes in the room full of bad guys. Pretty sure that writer was big fan of The Crow, looking back on it. But I would say this is a decent movie. It's good, but I think it's been elevated in people's minds because of the legend of the death of Brandon Lee during the shooting of the movie, which was indeed tragic. But I didn't enjoy it this time as much as I had previously. So I think it's decent, but not as great as a lot of people think it is, personally.
All right, very good. Jonathan Nolan must be a big fan of The Crow, because I think he wrote the Batman movie for his brother Christopher. The Dark Knight.
It may not have even been an intentional thought while he was writing that, but I bet you he's seen The Crow.
Yeah.
Right, but some of it is just down to the look. I mean, everyone sees, you know, the dressed in black, long trench coat, and they think The Matrix, you know, and this kind of got, not that it was a terribly original look to begin with, you know, but, you know, certainly The Crow got there first.
Yeah.
There you go.
So it is something I think that as a film, and I'm going to sound like I'm denigrating it. I'm not. It is something that really would seem to be aimed at hitting the angsty teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know, because it's got a lot of, for lack of a better term, some pretentious dialogue in it here and there that sound like uber deep and like,
yeah,
oh wow, you know, that's so cool.
Again, oh, by the way, Christy, when he quotes the Raven, is that Poe-esque?
Yes.
Yes, that is very Poe-esque. And I actually have some weird and interesting comments about that, because it's like, this is the Crow, dude. Like, what was that about? Okay. It's like, well, and you know what's interesting about a crow?
Is the bird that plays the crow look to me more like a raven? But
They used ravens in the movie instead of actual crows. I also noticed that his name is Eric DeRaven.
Yes. Yeah.
Which you might think is, wow, that's a really comic booky name, but it's not, because the comic book didn't ever use his last name. They just used his first.
Right. So they probably used ravens, because ravens are fairly easier to train, I think, than probably crows.
Well, ravens are smart as hell.
Yes.
Yeah, ravens, the thing is, crows and ravens are, in general, so difficult to tell apart. And ravens you can definitely train. I don't know that you can train crows as effectively. I know very little about that.
I will say that's one thing I actually really enjoyed about the movie is the raven vision, vision. When the bird's flying through the streets and he can see through its eyes, I did enjoy that effect.
Yep. It's like the monkey vision from that crappy
kind of like that, there you go.
George Romero movie. Yep. There you go. Or The Evil Dead, right? There you go.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so before we get into the movie, let's hear a wiki, Eric.
Wiki. A man brutally murdered comes back to life as an undead avenger of his and his fiance's murder.
And
if you don't mind, Phil, I'm going to start here with why I watched this movie, was kind of lukewarm on it. Because it seems, the way they told the story was, I mean, anything you see of him and his fiance's murder is in flashback form. And it was rather, it was really short flashes, didn't really see a whole lot of details, and I'm trying to figure out what I didn't understand after the story was told is why him? Why was the murder of he and his fiance so tragic so that he was given the chance for vengeance when I'm sure thousands of
people
were murdered every
year?
Because
he's just so deep and soulful. And his name is D. Raven.
Well,
I'll say this.
I can answer this for you, but go ahead, Phil.
Well, the reason it was told in flashback was because all that was filmed after Brandon Lee died.
Well, I get that part.
So they had to do it, right. But my point is that I think they would have probably developed the woman and the man so we could relate to them a little more had that issue not occurred, unfortunately. So they had to film. Basically, they didn't film the beginning until the end. And that beginning, they started putting in as flashbacks. But before we get into all that, I just wanted to discuss the Brandon Lee's death. But Chrissy, you wanted to answer Eric's question, so please do.
Well,
talk about Brandon Lee's death and the distribution of the film.
Yes, because all of the emo shit aside, what was really interesting about those flashbacks, and perhaps they were done, you know, for, like they said, Brandon Lee had passed and they needed to figure out a way to do it. I'm going to talk a lot about crows and what they mean and their symbolism. Crows are very revered.
I don't understand why.
In a lot, well, they just are. They're revered in Native American cultures. They're highly symbolic in Celtic, Celtic magic. They represent all sorts of different things. But the whole thing about my understanding of this, anyway, to answer your question, Eric, is that in the beginning, the girl comes on and she says that some people believe. It's said that the crow ferries the souls to the land of the dead, and that sometimes something so bad happens, a terrible sadness is carried with it, and sometimes the crow can bring the soul back to set things right.
Right.
That's what she says at the beginning of the movie.
That's what she says.
Right. The whole point of him coming back, and as opposed to no one else, was because he was specifically not at rest. In other words, because you notice she didn't get the opportunity to come back because her soul was at rest. And one of the reasons her soul was at rest was because she did not know he had passed when she died. And she also said to the cop, tell him to take care of Sarah. Sarah was her most important focus other than him.
Okay.
So she technically died at rest. He did not die at rest. And that is a very big thing when you get into, like, even sparrows, they say, carry the souls in and out of the guff. I mean, that's just a piece of, like, part of the mythology that goes with the crows and also with the ravens, too. Ravens, too, are farriers of the dead and messengers from beyond and all of this stuff. But so that's why, and that's just kind of why I accepted that and didn't question it, because I was like, oh, well, that makes total sense. He's not at rest. He's still pissed off. And so therefore he is, you know, lying in repose, you know, beyond in hell or heaven or wherever he went, or perhaps in purgatory, and he is still suffering. And so therefore this crow took pity on him and ferried him back into the world of the living so that he could get some closure so that he could finally go back and die and be at rest. The
that's
just why that was what I got out of it. What was interesting, you were talking about the flashbacks. I didn't read the comic, but it's also said that crows can simultaneously see the past, the present, and future all at the same time. So I was not sure if the filmmakers, or if it was in the comic, if it was done on purpose, or if this was just, as Phil said, a way that they had to do this to cope with Brandon Lee's loss, or maybe they just did it because it was the best way to tell the story. But I thought that was actually sort of brilliant, because I was like, well, they're definitely paying homage here to part of the mythology of the Crow, in that the Crow can see the present, he can see the past, and there's also a couple of snippets of the future that you kind of catch here and there. So that was what was kind of fascinating to me about this movie, is that I know a lot about Crow symbolism, and I was very fascinated by how many different things they crammed in here that were true to the mythology. And like I said, it might have been in the original comic. I don't know, because I didn't read it. So
that's all cool. And thank you for explaining all that. But it's like the manner in which they told the story, for me, I couldn't get invested in the characters because I didn't understand why it was so tragic, because we had no time with those characters.
Right. And I understand where you're coming from, too. Yeah.
Very fair.
And also, it was tragic, but it, like, thousands of murders happen in the United States every year, and I imagine hundreds of them would end up with that situation. So why don't we have bodies popping out of the grave all over the goddamn place?
Well, I mean, that's where you get to, why is it that it was, you know, Freddy Krueger came back? Why is it that Jason Voorhees came back? Mm-hmm. Anytime you see any of these, Back from the Dead revenge films, it's always, well, why that one?
Right. And
you know, it's to some degree, you kind of just, I don't know, I think you
no, but I guess I don't my think, bigger I don't issue is that I wasn't invested.
Right, but I think what Eric is trying to say is, like, for example, you know, we know why some creatures come back, because, you know, one of the Hammer films, a guy bangs his head on a rock, and the blood goes in a stream, and it falls onto a frozen vampire, Christopher Lee, and he awakens. You know. So certain things happen that give a reason why a certain creature comes. Someone, you know, summons a demon, and then, you know, you get Night of the Demons.
Right.
But here, I guess Eric's trying to say he didn't see it. But you have a good point too, Mike.
Christy explained it to good enough satisfaction for me.
Well, except
I think my bigger issue was not being invested in the characters.
Thousands of people come back, you know, whose souls are also not at rest. But that's just a thing. Why is it, if you buy into that mythology, why is it some people linger as ghosts who have unfinished work, and other people seem to be able to move on? And it's all kind of, you know, seemingly arbitrary to those of us in the world of the living. Maybe he just you know, won the ghost lottery. I don't know.
Right. So for example, if, you know, the chick in the ring gets killed and she comes back, and because her death was tragic and she's out to get revenge to anybody, but a lot of people get murdered and they don't come back and they're at rest. So it's a good question. It's the film, right? It's
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I was surprised by this, and maybe it's just because I know the film for, you know, so well, and I, you know, you tend to take things for granted with movies that you know well. But I imagine if I was watching this now for the first time, if, you know, I might have been where Eric was. This time around, in that they didn't give you backstory, didn't get time to know the characters, that you pretty much jump right in with both feet. And I kind of, though, liked it, because I don't think I wanted to see like 10 minutes of people complaining about housing petitions, you know, and, right. You know, I could fill in the blank. Oh, yeah, we know that they were engaged. We saw, you know, we fill in some of that in the background, and I guess, I don't know. I don't really feel like he's the main character, even though his name is on the title, right? You know, he's the vehicle that travels through the movie. He's the Jason Voorhees. You know, I feel more that Sarah and Ernie Hudson are really the main characters in the film.
Well, I didn't feel that at all. I could agree that it could be an ensemble cast, but I felt he was the main character myself.
No, I mean, I'm not talking about in terms of screen time. In terms of, you know, who learns, who grows through the film, who changes, right?
If you look at films that way.
Right, and that's my point. I don't know that I needed to feel his pain, right? You know, he's there to look cool and to kick ass and to do a rock and guitar solo on the rooftops. but you know, that's his thing. And then he dies. In theory, you know, I know there were like four sequels to this. There really is no reason for him to come back ever again.
Right.
You know,
I have not watched any of the sequels.
Well, obviously the sequels were.
And that's part of the reason why.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it doesn't matter. It's like, who wants to watch a sequel when the star of what made The Crow awesome isn't going to be in it anyway? So they're just cash in crap, probably. But I haven't seen any of them, so I can't.
Well, some of them are basically telling the same story with different characters.
Mm. Okay.
But I just find it funny that they all still wear his makeup, even though that wasn't his makeup.
Right.
That was his stage makeup. So
well, my inspiration comes from the Crow.
Let's get back into.
They're all just big fans of the.
Let's talk about.
Well, my husband. Hold on one second. My husband actually said that was like the most popular Halloween costume for years because it was easy to do. Well, it was just black clothes and some white makeup on your face.
Yeah, it was iconic for the era too. So.
Yes.
Makes sense. All right, so let's talk what happened. So what happened to Brandon Lee and what happened? So he dies, and I'll let Mike explain what happened since you followed the film since it came out. But after he passed away, they had to film parts of the film. They had to determine whether or not what to do. Should they just fold the film or not? And they decided to continue since there was only 3 days left of shooting anyway. And obviously, you know, I mean, the star, he passed, but I mean, it's his film, and you know, why not release it? So they had to refilm. They had to film 3 days worth of stuff with the flashback, which was the whole beginning, and they had to change the film around a little bit, and they used CGI. Basically, his double, Brandon Lee's double, stood in for him, and then they plastered his face on the double for those scenes. But then Paramount decided to pull out because they felt that whether it was in bad taste or whether they felt that the whole thing was just a disaster and it wasn't worth it. And so Harvey Weinstein and Miramax came in and threw in an extra $8 million into the film to do those last 3 days, which they were able to drag out because they had to rewrite stuff and all that. So what was supposed to be 3 days turned into a couple of months, and Miramax released the film as a result. And at one point it was even going to be sent straight to VOD, but they decided to, like I said, put that $8 million in and make sure that this got at the theaters. And as Mike said, it was one of the top 25 films of the year. So that's all I got, and how it got released. But Mike, explain what happened with the whole thing and Brandon Lee's tragic passing. I will say that he died at 28. His father died at 32. His father's death wasn't tragic in a sense. It was tragic because he was young, but it was natural causes due to some issue that he had, fluid in his brain that unfortunately made him pass. But he died very young as well. And then Brandon, though, it was most certainly a tragic death. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, oddly enough, I was reading up on this last night. I've always known the basic gist of the story, but it was it's amazing just how freaky this death is, how many little things had to kind of go wrong.
Total freak accident.
Well, because what happens is they fired a blank, and the blank wasn't blank enough, and they ended up killing him. So what happens, depending on what you do, you have different types of blanks, right? And so if you have a movie like whatever, John Wick, you know, where you don't see where you're not looking at a close-up from the gun, you're just seeing a distant shot, they use shells that do not have bullets in them. But when you have a revolver on close-up, you need to have a shell in there. You need a bullet in the shell because you'll see that there's nothing in the chamber on the gun. So they make these that have these bullets that have the slug in the cartridge, but they have no explosive powder in it. And for whatever reason, I guess because there were a lot of accidents on set, and part of it, you know, they attributed to having been filmed in, was it North Carolina?
I'm not sure where it was from.
It was a right-to-work state, so there was a lot of non-union stuff going on, and they were following non-union, not following union rules for that reason. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff done that was half-assed. Sketchy, you know, half-assed. And so there were a lot of injuries, apparently, on the set. I don't know if it's an unusual amount or if this is one of those things that, because people were looking to say that the film was cursed, they went back and looked to see what the mishaps had occurred. Because I'm sure in any big production, you know, you're going to get mishaps. But that's the story that they have kind of right now. And so they were taking some shortcuts, and so they tried making their own blanks. And so they made their own dummy bullets with the slug still in them. And they pulled out, they got the gunpowder out, but not the primer. And so in one scene... Now could only have happened near the end of the film. So the bullets are in there. This is the character Fun Boy, played by Michael Massey, I think is how you pronounce his name. There was primer there. It fired. It doesn't have enough force for it, you know, to shoot the slug out of the gun, but it got it lodged into the chamber, into the barrel of the gun. The actual slug. And then they reuse the gun later for the scene in the apartment, which they're filming at the end of the movie. And there they take those blanks where they don't have a slug in it, but they still have the charge in it. So you just get the good bang noise. And so when Fun Boy points the gun at... and is reusing this gun from an earlier scene, points the gun at Brandon Lee, pulls the trigger, the bullet is still lodged in the barrel of the gun. And the explosion, from the shell that has no slug in it, there was enough of an explosive force to spit the slug out of the chamber and ends up shooting Brandon Lee. And he wasn't even supposed to do that. It was an improv on the set he was told to do and directed to do by Alex Proyas. You know, so he could have very easily have just shot the gun into the wall. You know, this wasn't an intentional thing. He said, hey, why don't you shoot him in the chest? Okay, boom. And he shot him in the chest. And
I think it was the abdomen.
Or the abdomen, the torso. Yeah. Yeah. And he was rightfully, I think, cleared. They have, as a result of this, put much, much stricter regulations on using prop guns and blanks on sets in filming. It's unfortunate that this necessitated it. But, you know, all these little chain of events to happen, this is like a Final Destination death.
Yeah, yeah.
And
apparently it really messed up the actor for years and years after that too.
Oh, I imagine
he could not sleep at night.
I imagine. I mean, I'm sorry if I accidentally shot someone who wasn't a student. even though I wasn't the one who loaded the gun, even though I was told it was blanks, and I'm supposed to have professionals there on set that deal. You know, they have the prop masters, the stunt guys. I don't know for sure, you know, if they ever held anyone directly accountable for it. I know they ended up settling out of court with the widow for relatively, what to me seems like a relatively paltry sum of money.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it the widow, or was it his mother? It was his mother, I think they settled out.
Yeah, I think he was engaged. He wasn't married yet.
You know, it's unfortunate. And I don't know, was this really just a freak accident? Or was this negligence? Was this because they were being cheap and making their own blanks?
Well, all of the above. It was listed as a negligence by the government.
Okay, so yeah, and it's, you know, some things are more negligent than others, and it's like, yeah, it's really, really unfortunate. There's just no like word to capture how tragic and unfortunate that is. But it's just bizarre. It's just so bizarre that it was all these little things, because again, even if all of that happened, he was never supposed to point the gun at Brandon Lee in the first place.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that I don't know when in the year this movie would have been released. But I think it was only about a decade earlier that there was the big John Eric Hexum.
Is that the Twilight Zone film?
No, that was Voyagers. And that was an early 80s TV series, and I don't remember all the details because I was like 11 or 12 when it happened, or 13. But John Eric Hexum was on the set of Voyagers, and he was playing around with one of the prop guns that supposedly had blanks. And I don't remember, because I didn't look it up before this episode, I don't remember if he was like screwing around where he was like, oh, I'm going to kill myself and put it to his head, like his temple, and pull the trigger.
That's what
figuring
I think
it
happened,
was
yeah.
blanks. I think that's what happened. But I remember at, you know, whatever age I was, I want to say I was 12 or 13 when that happened.
It was a
that
blank.
Everybody was like, oh my God, never play with prop. Like in our school, it brought up this whole thing about never touch a gun. Even if somebody says it has blanks, don't play with it. Blanks are just as dangerous as regular
ammunition. Yeah, because what happened was, is he put the gun to his head, and even though there's a blank, the vibration and power that the gun has, even with no bullet coming out, killed his brain, basically.
Yeah.
Because so, there's still an explosive charge.
Yeah. But I'm glad that you explained all that, Mike, because I didn't get a chance to look it up, and I figured that, you know, about Brandon Lee's death, and I figured you guys would be able to explain it to me. So
I'm trying to remember where I saw some documentary on it. I can't remember where. Or what it was called, unfortunately, but they walked through everything that Mike was just talking about. Really just a true tragedy.
Yeah.
Before we go on discussing the movie, I do just want to mention one thing about Brandon Lee, which is that obviously before this movie came out, I saw him on a talk show at one point. It was one of the late night talk shows. I forget which one. And right before he had been on the talk show, apparently the week prior, he actually apprehended a burglar in his home using his martial arts skills. And so the host asked him about this, and he was like, it wasn't all that. I don't want to really talk about it. But he said, but one thought that occurred to me is that, and this is Brandon Lee talking, he's saying that in my living room, I have a blown up full wall size picture of me as a kid sparring with my father. And I gotta wonder if the burglar was walking across the room and looked over and just went, nah. And never saw this big picture of Bruce Lee fighting a kid and just was like, nah, he's just an enthusiast. No biggie.
And then he heard, wah!
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So I thought that was a cute story.
Well, I don't think he did the scream, Mike, because he was more the new wave versus his father, you know. So,
but it's not nearly as funny if he gets just hit, you know, blindsided. It's just
right. He just regains consciousness in the hospital. Right.
Well, in all the Bruce Lee films were ADR, so that's what
those things are pretty amusing too. Yeah,
it's kind of funny.
No, but it's a big bummer that that he died during the shooting of this movie from such a weird series of events. It's a bummer. He didn't go on to be the star he would have been.
Yeah, exactly. And he would be 53 today, so only a few years older than us. So it's kind of very sad.
Mm-hmm.
And he was engaged, like Mike said, so it's just a terrible thing. All right, so let's get into the movie itself. We did talk about a little bit about it, how someone that gets killed and his girlfriend gets raped and then dies 30 hours later from the abuse that she took from these scumbags, and he comes back with the magic of the crow that carries the souls and whatnot, as Sarah explains through talk over. Whether or not that's good enough, it depends on your perspective, but it is what it is. And that's pretty much the setup. Basically, a year later, he comes back from the grave to seek revenge, a year anniversary. And Sarah was basically this girl that lived in the neighborhood or his building, and her mother was one of those, what we would call, to be politically correct, absent a lot. And so she used to hang out with Brandon Lee's character, the Crow, and his fiance. And so she was getting a good development as a child because other people were looking after her while her mother was absent.
Well, her mother, let's just be fair, because I don't even feel the need to be politically correct about this. The mother was basically a drug addict.
Junkie
whore, I think.
An individual with behavioral health issues.
Junkie.
Right, but this was 1994, so they were just junkie whores back then. That was it.
No, political correctness was a thing back then, too, where it's never going away.
It's an evil thing, but it's never going away. It's good in most cases, but in some cases, I see the point of just junkie. Calling it for what it is, yeah. But anyway, continue, Christian. Did we lose?
Oh, I wasn't going to say anything else. I was just saying she
was a junkie whore.
Yeah, fair she enough. Was a junkie whore.
Right. Fair enough. So when they pass away to be Frank, raped and murdered, she's the one that gives a deposition to the police officer. The police officer that comes to the scene first is Ernie Hudson's character. She knows him. She explains exactly what I said, which is, you know, they kind of, she hung out with them. They were good friends of hers or caretakers in a sense.
They both hung out at the same hot dog stand.
There you go. And then the crime is listed as unsolvable, even though people have their idea who did it. In other words, it's pretty obvious who did it, but they can't prove it, so it's an open case with no solution type of thing.
Right. Well, this starts on Hell Night, the night before Halloween. And I have no idea what the reality is in Detroit of the traditions pre-Halloween, but in the comic book universe...
Oh, the fires are a thing.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of crime there, so you got to figure it's a busy night for the cops, and so... It's going to be really hard to figure out which particular set of assholes set this particular fire and murdered these particular people, because there's shit going on all over the place.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure this is like in Vancouver after they won the Stanley Cup and they burned the city down, that type of thing.
But they do it every year.
Yeah. Or Philadelphia when they won the Super Bowl 2 years ago, the same thing. So
Devil's Night fires in Detroit are a thing. That's not quite to the extent that they're shown in the movie, but it does happen.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you or somebody about, because they were showing the city just wildly on fire, and I was like, oh my God, okay, Devil's Night in my experience is like toilet paper and some eggs. I don't really understand what's going on here.
Detroit's a little rougher than Connecticut, Christy.
Honestly,
Christy has a rather lame devil.
Before this
I do. My devils are lame.
Before rewatching this film, I didn't even know there was such a thing as anything remotely as October 30th as being an important day in anything. So this was all new to me, to be honest. All
right.
I just know Halloween, you know, the 31st, but the 30th, I did not know this existed as Devil's Night until this movie, and I Wikipedia'd, and sure enough, it was there. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
One of my favorite lines in the film is when Michael Wincott's character is railing against how commercialized Devil's Night has become.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
They have Devil's Night greeting cards!
I will say another one of my favorite lines in this movie, and there were quite a few like kind of funny lines in this, is which was interesting to me because it just shows the time capsule. When Ernie Hudson or whoever it is in the opening scene of the film says, "Who the hell gets married on Halloween?"
Right.
And I'm like, dude, like, you know, 25 years from 1994. It's a thing. Everybody does this now on Halloween. But I think, back then. I think
my favorite one-liner from the film is, hey, I got a quick impression for you. Car, car, bang, fuck, I'm dead.
speaking of weddings, people should never have a wedding during a celebration weekend because it ruins it for everybody. You don't. Oh, that's right, Mike. You did. Sorry. But anyway,
we had it 2 days before Christmas.
Shots fired.
There you go.
You could have a really awesome Halloween wedding. I think.
I'm sure.
You just have to lean into it.
I'm sure you could. Well, you know what? I went to a wedding where it was a medieval wedding, and it wasn't on any, you know, specific celebration day. And people came dressed like medieval people, and if you wanted to, you didn't have to. So you can do it anytime. You don't even have to have it on Halloween.
No, but I'm just saying, if you do it, you make sure there's shit tons of candy. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Encourage people to come in costume.
Deck it out like the hotels do for Scarecon and Scare.
Yeah, you could go. You might have trouble getting it done in a church, but you could have fun with that. I mean, if you're doing it on Halloween, I have to think you're doing it on Halloween for a reason.
We're moving off the movie. We're gonna get back into the movie. So
you started it, Phil.
Yeah, okay. That's a fair point. Yeah. So. We have, in this Hell's Night, unfortunately, a death, which is Brandon Lee and his character and his fiance, who are murdered, and the girlfriend is raped continuously. And she's brought to the hospital and dies basically 24 hours later. Ernie Hudson's character, the cop, stays with her the entire time, most likely because... whether she had family or not, it never explained, but he felt close to the situation because obviously being the first person on scene, even if though he's a cop in a big major city, it was such a horrendous crime that even in a city where crime may be more apt to happen than a small town, it was probably something that he doesn't see every day, and it affected him deeply. So he stays with her, and unfortunately she does not make it either.
Know that he got busted down. He was a detective and got busted back down to being a beat cop.
And we don't know why, do we? I don't remember if I may have missed it.
Well, something that I can't remember what the line they used. It was, you know, clearly he wasn't doing what he was supposed to be. Like, it was his, you know, the fact that he couldn't stop asking questions or he didn't play ball or whatever it was.
Right.
You know, it wasn't that he did anything bad. It's that he didn't look the other way when he should have, or.
Perhaps it was that he was actually investigating that when the higher-ups didn't want it investigated.
Yeah. Well, and that was interesting because as much as I really adored this movie and thought it was very solid, and we talked about how, or at least I thought, it kind of held up all these years, the fact that, okay, I watched like every 1980s cop show that there was, and that was just a very 80s thing where the cop that was the lead in the story was always in trouble with his superior because he was either outspoken or he was doing something he shouldn't be doing or whatever. And so that little element of the story, even though it was not explained, kind of smacked of like 80s cop shows, and that really kind of pulled me out of realizing that, hey, this is not a modern movie you're watching. Like, we still got this 80s construct going on at this point where it's never really explained. And the cop, the boss there, the superior, just seems to have it out for Ernie Hudson, but we're never really told why. And so that was very 80s. But
yeah, it kind of made it, you know, sound
it was
like,
fine, but
it was like an unstated point that he was Detroit's version of Serpico. Kind of, sort of. So
he's the cop who gives a damn.
That's right. Internal. He was
the city that doesn't.
He was willing to work with internal affairs, the monkey around the police officer's neck.
Dance the monkey.
There you go. All right. So what do we want to talk about? I mean, the film is pretty straightforward. Basically, a bunch of crappy hoodlums, four or five of them. and Brandon Lee Coe's out to get revenge on them. And then there's the mob boss played by Wincott, who may or may not have something to do with the murder. And to be honest, probably would have not have been a victim of the revenge by Brandon Lee had he just not decided to kidnap Sarah at the end of the film. Because once he was really just going for the five people that did it. And then I guess the big twist is Wincott may have actually been the leader, right? I mean, at least that's what...
Well, it's not a twist. I mean, we know he's their ringleader.
Right.
But
the twist is that because Bei Ling advises him that he might be able to steal the crow's power, that's why he kidnaps the girl.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so it's funny, as I was watching it, I was like realizing, wait a minute, okay, so this is in a lot of ways, I was thinking, oh, a little bit like RoboCop, right? Because, you know, he's killed, and then he comes back and sort of ends up working his way through the gang one at a time that had murdered him.
You know, he just needed Ronnie Cox to play Wincott.
Yeah, and Ronnie Cox is the Wincott. And that has me in the mindset of now we got to see RoboCop at some point in the future.
Oh, and that Nancy Allen, I think her name is, would be the Ernie Hudson character.
She could be, or she could be Sarah. You know, it's the person you leave behind who's like, Murphy, is that you?
Right.
Because she sees it, she sees him twirl the gun and he hears her say, "Can't rain all the time."
Yeah.
Murphy, is that you? Yeah. But, so it's a pretty straightforward, and they go through one at a time, and of course they're all, every death is out of the handbook of ironic deaths.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the knife guy gets stabbed, the car guy gets blown up in his car.
I have a question. What was his beef with the pawn shop guy?
Oh, because he was the one that was willing to take the stolen property that was stolen.
Yeah, that's got nothing to do with the murder.
Well, that's technically, let me explain. He worked with the group of scumbags.
Let me explain.
And he didn't kill him. He used him to warn the rest.
All right.
He was using him to work his way back. He was an information piece.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, he was just he enables them by buying the stuff that they steal.
Right.
You know, and so he ends up sort of subsidizing their crime.
Right.
He could be
arrested for taking stolen goods, because technically pawn shop owners have certain laws where they have to prove of ownership and all this other stuff before, you know, of course, you know, those laws aren't really enforced, but either way.
I should point out a lot of great character actors in this film, and this guy, what was his name? Gideon? Or Gabriel?
Yeah, Gideon. I thought it was like Gideon. The Bible, right?
Yeah, Gideon. So Gideon was played by the great John Polito, who had been in a lot of different things, especially did a lot of work with the Coen brothers. Unfortunately, passed away, I think, in 2015.
Oh, he died young, didn't he?
I don't know how young he was, but he was not like 80.
Well, I'll tell you, he was 65.
60s, yeah, that's what I would have guessed.
Yeah, so it's still young for nowadays, I would say.
Especially for us. 65 is definitely young now.
Yeah, that would be unfortunate. Let's see how he died. Multiple myeloma. So is that the cancer, I believe? Yeah. Okay, anyway, continue, Mike. I'm sorry.
So I was just pointing out that was who was playing that. Again, right. A lot of character actors. You mentioned Tony Todd, Michael Wincott, Michael Massey. You know, there's... there's a lot of character actors in this film.
So basically, he kills the knife guy, finds him, then that leads him to the pawn shop guy, and then the pawn shop guy goes to warn Wincott's character, and on and on. So
right, the guy who's giving the drugs to the junkie whore, he stabs in the chest with the syringes, you know, send that message. So it's all good. And they work their way back, one death at a time, eventually to Michael Wincott, who is the gang leader, although he himself had nothing to do with his actual death. You know, he apparently just sent them there to like rough them up. He never intended them to talk sense into her for sending petitions around. And in reality, you know, they end up raping her one time. Right. And apparently, I didn't pick this up, is that they are murdered in the order in which they raped her.
Yeah, that's right. Good point. Good catch, Mike. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's disgusting when you think about it. Jesus Christ. I mean,
especially for the last guy.
No, on a serious note, but just for her, I mean, oh my God, this is terrible.
Yeah.
Because it's not just
they're horrible people.
It's a gang rape. I mean, it's just disgusting.
They are horrible, horrible,
yeah, they're absolutely horrible. They're total trash. Well, and that's the thing that about Top Dollar, which is the name of Wincott's character, is that if he was a real mob boss, like a professional mob boss that you know, everything's business, he would have had all those people killed because they murdered and they weren't supposed to.
So, I did write down. Yeah, I wrote down earlier in the film on my notebook. I wrote down best use of eyes since Blade Runner. Just because there's so many shots of the eyes of the crow and the characters, and eyes are all over the place. I figure Chrissy was going to talk about that at some point.
Yes, I'm definitely going to talk about that at some point.
Well, go ahead. Well, all right,
not now.
Right. Jump now. Well, jump in now and explain the whole crow eye bit and eyes, period. Chrissy, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff to talk about there.
Well, I mean, if you're connecting eyes to crows, you know, we'd already talked earlier that crows can see the past, present, and the future simultaneously. Crows also give one, or they can give one, the gift of second sight. So, you know, supposedly, if you have the power of the crow, you can see things that other people cannot. You know, you can see the underworld, or you can see the dead, or you can see, you know, whatever mythology that is being worked in the story, or in the story, for lack of a better word. That's kind of how that connection goes there. What's also very interesting is that the sister of Top Dollar, she's not the sister. Was that a joke? I just wanted to ask that. Or was that the girl that he was sleeping with?
I didn't understand. Well, first of all, they're different ethnicities. So it was a half sister, wasn't it?
Right.
I think that's what it was. That's what it was.
Yeah, something like that. Because then there was.
I think they even say it once in the film that it's a half sister.
Yeah. What was interesting about that is that we see her rip out the eyes of this girl that they're messing around with in the beginning. And then, of course, at the end, what balances that out is the crow pecks out her eyes at the end. What's interesting about that is that, okay, it's almost like there's a couple of lines in here where they say all the power in the world is in the eyes. And so the eyes are definitely a motif. But what's interesting is that when the crow takes out her eyes at the end, when he claws out the witch's eyes at the end, it's not only karma for all of the eyes that she has taken.
Right.
It's a symbol that she will always be blind to true power because she is not pure enough to possess it.
But she's dead.
Right. But if you... but. Even if she didn't die, she didn't die until after the crow pecked her eyes out.
Right, right, right.
She fell. But it was just kind of interesting symbolism. But it's not only about the gift of second sight. Eyes are the windows to the soul. So supposedly you can see evil in someone's eyes, or you can see true, you know, you can see true love in someone's eyes. You can see true passion in someone's eyes. You can see hatred. You can see anger. That's why they say eyes are the mirrors to the soul. So the fact that the witch in particular, I'm just going to call her the witch to make it easier, was removing people's eyes also said that she didn't want to look into the souls of other people. She just wanted all of the power for herself. In other words, these people and their souls were not important to her unless they were feeding her own power. We also, of course, have all of these allusions to eyes in mythology, like Greek mythology and Shakespeare. You know, there's the witches that share the one eye.
Yep.
Do you guys remember?
Yes.
I don't remember where that's from.
That was in Greek mythology.
Greek mythology.
The Grey Sisters or something like that.
Yeah, where they share one eye. So I think overall, because I was writing down every single reference to sight and eyes that there was, and I came up with at least 17 of them. There are probably more that I might have missed. But overall, I think what this movie was trying to say with that particular motif is that you always have to be aware that your power comes from your own soul. And it's how you use that power and how you see whether or not your power can be used for good or evil. That is kind of what I got out of it. Does that make sense to you guys?
So yes, that's a good point, Chrissy. Absolutely. And again, this film is loaded with this stuff, this symbolism stuff, and the crow. I mean, obviously, it's called the crow. The crow.
Well, the ring is a big symbol too. The
ring. Good point.
Huge.
Because the ring falls, and the crow notices and gives it back to her.
Yep.
But the interesting thing about the ring is that it was a symbol of a bunch of different things. It wasn't just a symbol for, oh, their true love. I mean, the symbol of wedding ring, the engagement ring, it's the idea of karma, for one thing. Everything you do,
comes
back.
It's the
karma.
Idea of-
Yes.
Karma, okay.
Yep. Karma, that you put something out and it comes back to you. Also, the idea that life is a circle, right? I mean, think of The Lion King, the circle of life, and that men are born, they live,
and
they die.
And then they come back and kick ass.
Right. And what's interesting about this is he does come back from the dead. So the ring is almost suggesting that this is a cycle that is starting that is going to continue.
Okay.
With him in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ring is also a symbol of unity in that, you know, he is united with his own grief and that he is going to continue to live this grief and this sorrow until he takes his revenge and has his peace and lays it to rest until he gets closure. He's going to stay in this cycle. So the engagement ring was also a really interesting symbol. So we have the eyes, the engagement ring. There were a few other things. I really couldn't figure out the symbolism of the knives and the syringes. It was almost like he did them in a pattern on those two bodies, and I just didn't get a good enough look at it. Did you guys?
Well, I think if I counted correctly, I think there were 5 knives, but I didn't see a pattern specifically. I think
was
there
it
might
a pentagram?
Have been, maybe?
Or a cross, maybe? I don't know.
I don't think it was a cross. It looked too circular for that, but I didn't get a great look at it either.
Right.
Well, and there's also what's interesting about the number 5 is that the number 5 is not only associated. I mean, there's a million things about the number 5 in numerology, and I'm not going to go into that here because I'll be talking all night. But a pentagram has 5 points. I think in medieval England, there was a special kind of knot that was tied in a way that had like 5 points. And I think they called that a lover's knot because it was there was an association there with their love goddess, which I think is interesting because, you know, this is about lost love, like he lost his love. So, I mean, that could be part of it. I don't know. On the other hand, they just could have picked 5 because he wants to make sure he gets his 5 victims. You know, the 5 people that hurt him, he wants to make sure he gets them.
Right.
And so maybe they just picked 5 for that reason, but I think 5 is an interesting number. I mean, they could have easily picked 4. 4 is the number of death in a lot of religions. 4 is, you know, they could have picked they could have picked 3, symbol of the Holy Trinity. They, you know, so why'd they pick 5? Like,
right.
There had to be some reason there. So he picked 5.
Right. Well, if you do the cross, it makes sense, 5, because, you know, the top, the bottom, the two, right, left, and the center, and then the pentagram, obviously, is five. So yeah, I mean, it could be a multiple of things. I mean, I don't even remember. Eric, you may remember, since you're a big fan of the film, too. The Omen, wasn't it five knives?
Seven knives.
Oh, it was seven? Okay, all right.
Yeah. See, no, I think it should just be a coincidence. They say, I think it's Ernie Hudson who says it, is that he gets stabbed in all of his major organs in alphabetical order. I don't know how he would know that.
Oh, I just thought that
and
was
also
cool
what
cop
he
talk.
Considers to be a major
yeah, that's
organ.
What I would have guessed.
I just thought that was cool cop talk. Like more 80s cop show talk.
Yeah,
like that's kind of
that
what
literally.
I was like, that's 80s cop show talk. Yay.
Yeah, so I was looking up on the Crow Wikipedia fan page.
Yeah.
Just that it suggests, and it's a good point, because he does come to the pawn shop later and says that Tintin told him that he had the ring, which we never see on screen. So maybe he was actually torturing him for information.
Interesting.
And that's why, you know.
Makes sense.
Right, because we see him stab him like in the, wasn't it like in the upper, like in the, like near the right shoulder?
Right.
Area at first, yeah. So he yeah, didn't. First. So that wasn't a killing blow, and then later we pull back. We right. saw he's.
Yeah, I mean, if he's willing to kill these people for revenge or justice, depending on your point of view, I could see him also torturing these people again, depending on your point of view, for revenge or justice, because he needs information to find the rest of the scumbags.
Right, and I think he actually kills the. What's his name? Fun Boy? What the one that that's dishing out the drugs?
Yeah, I think that was his name.
I think he kills him and then he stabs him in the chest with all the syringes. So I think it may just be a coincidence that it might not have even been five syringes. I don't remember.
Mm.
Yeah.
How many there were. So I don't know if there was a specific significance beyond. This might be one of those cases of us looking for significance when it was just, well, because we had five right. knives.
Well, I will say one cool thing. You were talking about the syringes. One cool thing I did enjoy upon rewatching this movie that I didn't recall from previous watches was when the Crow confronts the mother, Sarah's mom, and makes the morphine come back out of the injections. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that scene was actually pretty
cool. Yeah, that was awesome.
Well, it shows you the type of trash this woman is, because she's hanging out with a rapist murderer, you know? I mean, that's just pathetic. So he kills him because he's one of the rapists and murderers of his fiance and himself. And then he takes her and he basically scares the bejesus out of her, saying, "You got to be a good mother."
Yeah, get your shit together, lady.
yeah, because obviously he cares very much about Sarah, and so, you know, I mean, without him and the fiance, Sarah is pretty much alone now. So, you know, shape up, or you know, you're screwed. And so she actually, at least in one scene, turns it around and becomes a good mother. And we hope that continues and doesn't result back to, like, 3 weeks later you become a junkie.
I kind of enjoyed that scene too. I thought it was well done, because clearly she doesn't really know how to be a good mom, but she's trying. And the daughter, who's become street tough, you know, is giving her all sorts of attitude and calling her by her first name, and then realizes when things are about to go south that having a crappy mom that's trying is better than having a no mom.
Right.
and so she starts calling her mom again and things get better. I thought, I mean, yeah, it happened in a really short period of time, but I thought it was well done.
Yeah, I it was heartwarming, because here is the mother, you know, trying, but you can understand why Sarah would say, whatever, you know, you've been a shit mother for years, and now you're trying to pretend you're good. And the mother says, "All right, fine, I give up. I'm gonna just, you know." And then Sarah immediately says, "Oh, she was serious. She was really trying. She wasn't just being
right.
a patronizing."
Well, she also realized she's hurt her mother.
Yeah, that's right? a good point too.
And as angry and legitimately angry as she is with her mother, it's still her mom. And, you know, her mom may be a neglectful mom, but I don't think we ever get a suggestion that she was an abusive mom, or, you know, like a physically abusive mom.
Right.
That's correct. Although neglect is a different type of abuse, but that's, you understand my point.
We do.
So, you know, what I like about this whole sequence is that it shows there is more to Eric than just revenge. He isn't just Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
You know, is that while he has a specific
agenda. Oh, he's a good agenda, guy. No doubt about it.
You know, he is there. You know, he's still, he hasn't lost his humanity. He's pissed, but he's not, and he's a spirit or a revenant, but he's not in human.
Right. He's basically, like the movie Death Wish, which came out a few years earlier, 20 years earlier, actually. He doesn't have the supernatural powers to find the people that did him wrong and his family wrong. So he decides to randomly kill evil people. Here, the crow, it knows who the villains are and can find who they are and is specifically going after them. And anybody who stands in his way, who, like, the top doll is, you know, minions, he has to take them out too, but that's not his intention. His intention is specifically the five people that maybe not even killed him, but really did what they did to his fiance. So, yeah, I mean, it's wrong to get vengeance, and, you know, I mean, because technically, if he was alive, he would be charged for first-degree murder because he's intentionally killing people, even if they deserve to die, based off of what they've done to him and his fiance. But it's understandable, even so, right? I mean, I'm not talking smack here, am I?
Anyone? No, it's about time you came around. Murder isn't always wrong.
Well, I won't go that far, but.
I will.
Well, let me explain here, Eric, is that when we were talking about the Prodigy and the murder and that, it was just this woman that happened to escape a serial killer, and now they're going to kill her because that's will stop the curse. So she didn't deserve it. These people did. These people are scum.
Right.
All right. So give me that.
Yeah, but you've defended, you know, scum from being murdered too in the past. Just saying.
That's true. I usually say they should
We're wearing them down, Mike. We're wearing them down.
They should put them. Well, based off of the FBI and the law officials I see recently, you can't really trust justice anymore. So I have
pretty soon he'll want to join you for the child murders, Mike.
Well, I did laugh listening to a podcast, and it had somebody make their politically correct statement. I'm against the death penalty. The death penalty is never right. It's never the right thing to do. But,
you know, There's the but.
But, it's okay. So.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's always easy to say but when it isn't your family, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's,
yeah. I mean, there's some people that will always be pacifists no matter what, because, I mean, I forget the kid's first name, but his last name was Berg. That was killed by terrorists in Iraq. His father did not want the U.S. government to take out that terrorist, even though they did. I forget his name. And then the woman whose daughter that got murdered in Iowa last year, she by a non-citizen, she's now taking in non-citizens as boarders in her house, just to make a point. So some people will always not, but again, that's just some people. Other people will obviously want justice for the death of their family members, obviously. So I guess it depends on each individual.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. I mean, most people would want justice for someone who is wrongly murdered.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. For no reason except for
evil. I just want everybody to die because people suck.
Well, they kind of do. I did, what is that, new pound signed or whatever it's called, a hashtag sign.
Hashtag?
The meteor, something meteor. I forget what it's called. I read it today.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Meteors of death.
Yeah, that's it. The meteor of death. Meaning that, basically that means that.
Right?
Yes, you're right. Basically, they're waiting for the giant meteor to hit the earth and just kill everything.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yes, well, that's called Spot.
Meteor of Death.
Yeah. All right, so Abe just joined us, actually. How are you doing, Abe?
Hey, how's it going there, guys?
Good. So let's ask your opinion of this film. Your first time seeing it, when, how, and your opinion and all that other good stuff.
Well, The Crow, I first remember seeing it maybe on TV a couple of times. Little sparse moments here and there, but I got the whole gist of the thing. The passing of its lead actor and the accident that took place. But it's been a long time since I've ever watched it in its entirety. So tonight, which I forgot tonight, it was our actual recording, so I watched it all the way up to that, to this very moment. And I like it. It has a nice visual style. I thought the performance of Brandon Lee was very strong. And it was actually a lot of familiar faces, among them being Ernie Hudson. It's very 80s, but it's got that very fun kind of B movie feel to it. But it's got also a visual style that's kind of difficult to describe.
Dark. It's dark.
Very dark, but I'm saying
it's rainy.
Oh yeah. Yes, rainy too.
Actually, I don't think there's a daylight scene in the whole movie.
No, there isn't actually. Well, actually,
you might be right. I'm having trouble remembering any scenes in daylight except for maybe like a couple when Top Dollar and his minions are kind of sitting around in their little boardroom or whatever.
It does stop raining towards the end because it can't rain all the time.
Fine, yes.
That's right.
Anyway, continue.
Yeah, so, as I was saying, I did really think the movie is a lot of fun. And, I could definitely see the moments where they had to try to work around the tragic accidents, certain editing and certain stunt doubles and stuff like that. But it works. They managed to finish a strong film, a very fun film, a very stylish film. And it's definitely worthy of its cult classic status. I remember only little bits of it until that tonight's viewing. I usually watch a film and try to think over some things before the recording, but with everything fresh in my mind, there's a lot of things that I really enjoyed. Very little I did not like. Most of the sets and stuff like that were a part of this time, but they in a way add to that the film's unique presentation. I'm very glad because I do want to talk about this film as much time as I had left to get on here, because I did like it, and it's among the films that if you ever seen a lot of genre films and stuff like this, this is among to kind of say that you've seen it, whether any of you like it or not. I liked it. It's a film I definitely recommend to check out to kind of see, kind of an interesting take on this superhero film, a dark superhero film, but one I would say is very different from what is now the norm of that subgenre.
That's true. I mean, even the Christopher Nolan Batmans are completely different than what we see now for a superhero film. I mean, when I think of a superhero film, I think of like the last Thor film, actually, to be honest. But either way, all right. So very good. So let's continue to talk. What are the things we want to discuss in the film? Any specific scenes and whatnot? I actually liked how the Crow, again, had no interest to kill any evil person. He just wanted to kill the five people that basically did horrible things to his fiance and himself. And
well,
He took a few bad guys out at the big battle at the end.
He had to, though, because he said, I just want that. I just want whatever his name was. And they wouldn't give him to him. And then so he's forced to take out everybody.
Plus, they shot him right afterwards.
The moral of the story is whenever somebody doesn't give you what you want, you should kill them.
Well, if they put a few bullets in you, then maybe the toxin off.
In other words, all those minions plus Top Dollar would not have been considered to be targets if they had just given him the rapist.
Yeah.
Right.
I found it interesting that Brandon Lee, with his martial arts background, I was really glad we did get a sword fight before the end of the movie. But there's a lot of gunplay. Lots of gunplay in this movie.
One of the things I really did like about it is that it adds that kind of 80s B movie vibe is the very fact that there's no actual count of how many rounds anybody has.
That's true.
Everybody's just blasting rounds constantly. Brandon Lee's wielding two pistols and he's shooting like more than a machine gun can hold.
Yeah, but that's because they're ghost bullets.
I don't think he can use ghost bullets.
I have to say that the thing is that I think this was also Brandon Lee, it was a perfect film for him because even though he had the martial arts skill to do, you know, he doesn't have to be trained specifically for this film, say like Brie Larson had to for Captain Marvel or whatnot, because he already knew how to, you know, do his own stunt stuff. I think it had a little enough karate or martial arts or whatever it's called. So because he was intending, I think, to move into more of a action hero like a Vin Diesel or a Bruce Willis, and he just happened to have the ability to also do martial arts if it was required. In other words, he wasn't planning to do what his father.
Wish there'd been more martial arts. I would have found it more interesting.
Right. Yeah. No, that's fair. I actually liked it better this way because I was never been a martial art fan for that type of film because I always felt like, why are they fighting with swords and stuff when all they have to do is pull up the gun and shoot the people? And technically, I mean, in modern days, I mean, if it's obviously a period piece, that's a little different. But I've always had issues with films that have these big fist fights and all this other stuff and no one's pulling out a gun because you know someone has a gun, especially if it's in the United States. So, you know, like a bar fight or bar room or any fight where people are getting killed, someone's going to have a gun eventually and start shooting. So I felt this was really good because it played enough of that cool fist fight, sword fight stuff, but not overboard to make me roll my eyes in a world where the modern age where folks were more apt to have projectile weapons.
But I did kind of like how the sword fight, the guy, the crow pulls off the other pew of the church as the makeshift sword. I thought it was actually pretty fun little moment right there. Just the perfect shape for the job.
There you go. Yep.
I actually, for this, I would have liked for Brandon Lee to have one American film before, you know, where he could do his martial arts. He only had a moment or two where he could use it. But given who the character is in this film, I don't know that it would have been completely appropriate, you know, that he was.
Right.
That it made more sense that
he should have at least got to stab somebody with an electric guitar.
Well, that's the thing. This character that he was playing wasn't a martial arts person, right? It just felt like he was supposed to be the dude.
Yeah, but he was also fucking undead
from Mission Impossible. Well, that's true, but a lot of these vampire films that I've seen in the past that have these vampires that are like superheroes, I roll my eyes and don't like because they don't remind me of horror films because even though there's a vampire in it. So here we have a rat wraith, right? That's how you pronounce it. Who are revenant for or something like that, and I'm glad they didn't go that route where they have these superhero, you know, vampire, pseudo vampire. I felt that was, thank God they didn't go that route because then I would have hated this film. But that just may just be me. Some people may have felt that
we should have guns in our supernatural movie.
Why not? Because it's the modern era, right? We're not talking about 18, you know, 60 or 1910 or whenever Dracula was supposed to take place. We're talking about it was 1994. It was actually
fine, whatever.
Yeah. So you should have guns, because, you know,
whatever. I mean,
if it was 2019,
whatever.
Trolls too, and the internet,
whatever,
and trolls.
Moving on.
Fair enough. It's just an observation, Eric, opinion. That's all.
You're not allowed opinions.
Okay, what else? Any other items, specific scenes, symbolism, Chrissy, anything? Anybody that wanted to bring up that they wanted to bring up that we haven't talked about yet?
I'm trying to... So, the villain's henchwoman, how does she know that the crow gave Eric his powers?
Because she's a witch!
Right. Eric had said... Well, she did... Yeah, because you remember she was doing that weird shit with the eyes where she'd
take people's eyes. I thought she was just being weird. I honestly thought they were just... I honestly wasn't sure there was witchcraft or something like that because...
It wasn't developed well enough. That's a fair point, Abe.
Because I thought they were just sick fetishes considering that they killed the woman in their bed and stuff like that. So I was like, okay. But...
Right, there was no reason to kill that woman because obviously they had a three-way with her, and then they just say, you know what, let's just kill her because we're psychopaths. But
so I thought their use of her eyes was just something they had for kicks or something like that. So.
Right, exactly. That, and again, you could get it that way, and I pretty much felt it was that way too until the end where, out of the blue, she's, as Eric stated, what is she, Eric? What is she?
She's a witch!
Right.
Well, but no, that goes back to what I was saying earlier before Abe was here, where, you know, like she takes out the eyes of that girl and then she burns the eye, and they believe that eyes were the source of all the power, which was what I was talking about earlier. And she and Top Dollar want power. So she obviously is practicing. Yes, I agree with everybody here. They did not make this clear in the film. It didn't become clear to me until the end when she was like, if you take the raven, you will have that power. So they were just drunk with power, really. And Top Dollar kind of points that out later in the film when he says greed is so amateurish, right? What he really wants is power. He's not really into money. He's into power. So that's what that whole eye thing was. But no, it wasn't very well established because I didn't get that she was really a witch. I was just like, oh, it's these freaky druggies burning eyes. It took me a little time to figure it out, you know?
Right, and that's how, Abe, you felt too, right? They were just freaky.
Yeah, because they felt like without any kind of development, it was hard because they felt like out of nowhere motivation for them to suddenly kidnap the young girl and then try to stage this whole thing to get the raven.
Yeah, and that's how I felt it too, Abe, is that I just thought they were just freaky psychopaths that had orgies of violence and sex, and that's all the burning of the eyes were. And then at the end, we find out, oh, maybe she actually does have some sort of witch powers. And it wasn't established well enough, I think, earlier. But it makes sense in the world that they're in, because obviously if Brandon... Lee's character comes back as the crow, supernatural wise, you know, it wouldn't surprise me that other supernatural beings, and being a comic book film, you know, I mean, we have people with all these special powers or abilities, you know, that make sense in those comic book movies, but in real life or even in a regular horror film would be like, say, what? They didn't establish it, you know? So... go on, Mike.
Yeah, I was going to say one thing that I thought was interesting to point out. It was in one of the things I was reading last night. I think it might have been on IMDb. It's been suggested because notice that the bullets start affecting him at the end.
Yes, because once the crow was wounded, he loses his power.
Yeah, he loses his protection.
But that was a little bit confusing because... The witch basically said you have to kill the crow in order for him to lose his power. So I thought, now that you guys mentioned this, I'm glad you did. I did kind of find that, well, what's going on here? because the crow's still alive. So why? That was a little bit inconsistent.
I was watching for that. I was sure this is some kind of pumpkin head thing where, you know, they hurt the one source to hurt the other kind of thing, you know, where and Pumpkinhead, Ed Harley gets hurt, then Pumpkinhead feels the pain because, you know, the bird gets hit in the wing and he gets hit in the arm, but it didn't feel, the whole rules were kind of weird because she's holding the bird. She has every opportunity to just shoot it or break its neck, and she doesn't do that. And so they had to have the bird alive. So I was confused there. I was like, wait, couldn't you just kill it and then put an end to this whole thing?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a story hole or something there. There was something inconsistent about that.
I think the deal was that if you kill the crow, it takes away his powers, but the crow is dead. I think what she was trying to accomplish is to steal his powers somehow, for which she needed the crow alive, maybe? That's a guess, not a fact.
Right. So, anyway, there's a character in the comics that was supposed to be in the movie, I think it was played by Michael Berryman, and then ended up deleted, called the Skull Cowboy. And I guess he's an earlier recipient of the crow powers, and he sort of is serving the guide portion, the explaining what you're supposed to be doing now, that they decided to cut out of the film. But I guess in the comics, he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, and he ends up being cursed to, like, forever walk the earth. But his goal is to come back and kill the people who raped and murdered his wife. He does that, and he still hasn't gone back because going after Michael Wincott, who didn't rape and murder his wife.
Right. But he only does it because they kidnap the girl, Sarah.
Right. But the point is that he may be losing some of his power. That was a suggestion that was offered, was that maybe he's losing some of his power because he's staying beyond. His
mission's already accomplished.
His mission's already accomplished, and he's doing something he's not charged to do.
So perhaps the bad guys are just misinformed that they were just guessing.
Well, we don't know what the crow would has anything to do with it, and it is kind of vague as to exactly why that's happening, right? Does she have to kill the crow? Is it because the crow is wounded? What exactly is it that does it?
Yeah, it gets, and also, it's just like, also, think of the powers. Towards the end, Top Dollar gets taken out when Eric somehow transmits his fiance's pain to him. That was kind of a last minute thing that I didn't know he could
do. I was going to bring that up.
It's okay. We still. it's still not as bad as Dorothy dumping the bucket of the water on the Wicked Witch.
Because, like, how does he have that pain to give? That's what I don't understand.
Well, he got the memory of it. Well, because he got it from Ernie Hudson, right? That's what he says. He thanks him for giving him the way to save his life. So, I don't know. But it's good. But Eric, it's deep. It's so deep.
I mean,
his eyes are dreamy.
I mean, there was a nice little payoff of seeing the guy next to Corey Shaw, the top dollar, just impaling himself on the gargoyle horns.
And yes.
That was a pretty good shot, but I was like, wait, but how did he... Maybe you could have used that earlier or something.
So clearly there were a couple of script issues since we're also confused about this.
But it's very possible some of those could be attributed to Brandon Lee's death.
They had to rewrite part of the film. Yeah,
but I don't think the rewrites were as extensive as we think they were because they were almost done.
Yeah, yeah, there's 3 days of shooting left.
That's true. That's a good point, actually.
Yeah. They did. Obviously, it was longer than 3 days, like I said, because the Weinstein Miramax folks took over the film, and then they threw in an extra $8 million, and the shooting continued for another few months.
That is a lot of money for 3 days.
Well, they changed it. What they did was they brought in a lot of computer graphics to make the flashbacks, yeah, exactly.
Right, and this is very, very early CGI days, you know, and so this isn't extensive use. It's
right, and it must have been expensive back in those days, right?
Yeah, I imagine.
Even if it was minimal, it must have been expensive as hell versus nowadays that you can you know, do it
in your living room.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people can take a game engine and create their own levels, for crying out loud, because the game companies give out the engine, so you can create your own levels. And
I mean, you do it. It's face swapping is such a total thing, you know, on your cell phone.
Yeah.
And that's really all they did.
Yeah, Neil Lemoy does it to all. To me, he's done it to Dustin Watson on Facebook. Yep, it's the truth. My cousin Kenny Bonin, for my birthday, posted a happy birthday, Phil, and he had me on stage with Taylor Swift. So it can be done. It can be done.
And that didn't actually happen?
I know. It was devastating.
No, it made Phil cry.
Jesus.
Can we wrap this up?
Yes.
I missed seeing that. What was that Christmas movie, Mike, that you're a fan of?
I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday?
Yeah, it was premiering, or not premiering, but they were showing it with the director in-house at Scares the Kid last weekend. I mean, not last weekend, last year. And I skipped it so I could make sure that I won the Taylor Swift autographed photo, because it was it was more.
Yeah, so just so you know, they're not doing silent auctions this year. They're doing actual auctions.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That sucks. I'm not going to do that then. That's too stressful. I don't like it.
It's not the way they do it. It's silent, but you're there. So it says, anyone interested, for $10, raise your hand.
And then
you keep raising the price until there's only one hand left standing up.
That's stupid. I mean, there's hundreds. That's going to be hundreds of items. It's going to take all day.
Well, we don't know how many items they're going to be doing this year.
Yeah, no, I don't like it. I don't like it.
Anyway, shall we wrap this up?
Yeah, I guess we can wrap it up. All right, so let's do a couple of things here. So, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play.
Very good. And Mike, me and you are doing another podcast right now on the side. Plus, we do other podcasts with Eric, and you actually also do a blog.
Yeah, well, the blog is Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com. And the other podcasts on the side, we have one that just started back up, which, of course, we mentioned earlier, Searching for American Gods. And in just about a month, we're going to be coming back with more of You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, the Game of Thrones podcast. And then sometime far, far, far in the future, there will be the third season of Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast.
And I would like to state that the You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, we're being joined by the great Eric Webster.
There's another Eric Webster?
Oh, waiting for something. That was bad. I mean, it was good. It was funny, but woo, that was a low one. All right, very well. Chrissy, you do things.
I do. I mostly write short, dark fiction. My blog has been a little bit slow lately, but you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
And, hey, where can people find us on the web, Dark Discussions?
You can visit us at DarkDiscussions.com. All episodes we have uploaded right now are there to listen to. And are free. But there's more to come. And if listening's not enough, you can also look on the right-hand side. There'll be links to blogs and other sites that might tickle your fancy. Other podcasts and stuff like that. So just drop by and give us a visit. And have fun.
Yep, and emails darkdiscussions@AOL.com. Please send your emails and give us your opinions, feedbacks, your comments on films that we've covered or films that you've seen at theaters or on VOD that you want to give a little review on. We'll read it all out on the podcast. Even though we said this once, well, Eric, since this was specifically a Patreon episode, what was that all about, this Patreon?
You're really going to make me do this again? All right.
We need an online service
that allows you to donate to support your online artists. You can go to the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate, you will have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. All submissions are drawn on a quarterly basis. For more details, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
That's right. And me, Mike, and Eric, and possibly Abe and Chrissy will be joining us at ScareCon New England, which is in Framingham, Massachusetts. And what are those dates, Mike?
June 7th, 8th, and 9th. I believe you and Eric will be there the 7th, 8th, and 9th. I will be there the 8th and the 9th. And, yes, so they've started announcing guests, and we mentioned that there's the last week they've got the most of the cast and the director of the first Phantasm film, and Felissa Rose is going to be there, and I was going to say Nancy Kerrigan, but that's not it. Played Nancy in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies.
Yes,
Heather Langenkamp and Cassandra Peterson, better known as the woman who found me amazing, Elvira. Those are the people that you. those are some of the guests they've announced. I haven't heard anything new, but as the date gets closer, I'm sure you're going to hear more. Maybe next week we'll talk more about our what's turning into an annual get together at Mystic Kinetic, and what's looking some really nice stuff in the cards for Scares That Care. If anyone wants to go see us there in August.
Right, besides the new way
that the Taylor Swift auction.
The auction, yeah, that's not good. But Eric, July the 26th, 27th, and 28th, where are we going to be and people can join us?
Mystic, like Mike just said.
That's right. Yes. As Mike said, it's a yearly thing that we've been doing for the past couple of years. We meet up on Friday the 26th. We're going to meet up for pizza at Mystic, Connecticut, at Mystic Pizza. And then we're going to go see a movie, possibly Quentin Tarantino's new release, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and do a live, well, not live, but live in person that will be recorded, episode of the movie. For our podcast, darkdiscussions.com. So that'll be exciting. And then me and Mike and anyone else who wants to join us will be at Scares That Care. I think it's the following weekend, right, Mike? The 3rd, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of August?
So whatever that first weekend in August is, and it's there it's unofficially starts Thursday night with a viewing party at the swimming pool. And then I'm assuming they're continuing that tradition this year. And then
It's the thing this year at the pool.
Which thing?
The movie, the thing. John
Carpenter's thing. The thing, or the original thing, or the remake thing.
You know which one, Mike? Because they're having.
No, I honestly don't know which.
They're having a big reunion of a bunch of people from John Carpenter's The Thing. Scares That Care this year, and so they're doing that movie as the pool movie this year.
That's unusual because they have avoided doing anything that was R up till this point.
Well, this is the first time, I guess. Yep.
It's okay. R.
Yep. There you go. Yeah. That's a good point, Mike, because it is a family event, and some people still would not want their children to see an R-rated movie, whether it's nudity, violence, or language.
I still can't mention talking about The Thing with my father. He still has to say, "Yeah, there's so much bad language in it."
There sure is. Which,
not a single word uttered in that film that I have not heard my father mention many, many times.
Indeed. Indeed.
So if there are any children in the pool watching the movie, you must immediately submerge them under the water so they can't hear.
Right. And Mike would say, just hold them there forever.
That's where I was going with that.
Not forever, just about 5 minutes.
Right. Now, Mike, you can. I'll ask you once we get offline why they're changing the auction, because I have no idea why. But very well. So let's do our final thoughts on this film. So let's start with you, Abe, since you joined us late.
I'm really glad I got to jump on tonight. I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was really well shot. I thought the performance was pretty strong. It's a fun movie. There's some little plot things here and there, but they're not that big of a deal, to be honest. The visual style is really cool. Really cool 80s soundtrack. Some cool action scenes. It's a fun dark superhero film, and one that is, as I said earlier, deserving of its cult following. And I suggest, if you've watched a lot of genre films, to check this one out. If you have Netflix, it's right there to watch. And overall, really like this film. A lot of fun. And that's it for me.
All right, very good. Thanks, Abe. I did some research, Mike. It's actually the Sweet Meteor of Death. That's the hashtag. It's a great hashtag. It's awesome. All right, so let's go with you, Mike, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so like I said, this is certainly it's a cult film. If you're talking, I don't know if it's a classic in terms of the Godfather kind of classic, but it is certainly a classic of the genre in its own way. Like I said, I really think if you have a teenage girl, they'll really love this movie, especially if they're kind of gothy or into the darker stuff. But it's not a bad film. It still stands up, I think, as a pretty solid comic book movie, and one that doesn't rely too heavily on excessive CGI and overly long battles and things like that you see a lot in the modern ones, and gets a lot out of just mood and atmosphere. And, you know, Alex Proyas shot the hell out of this film. Brandon Lee, tragically, is very charismatic in it for what he's allowed to do, given that he's basically a guitar-wielding murder machine. Check it out. Free on Netflix. I was amazed that it was still free on Netflix when I had to watch it for the podcast, because I was fully expecting them to pull it, as soon as we decided to do it. But it's there for once. One of our Patreon films is there free for people to see. So go do that now.
Yay!
Very good. Chrissy?
I had never seen this before, and I was really glad that I waited. I think that it has definitely withstood the test of time. I think it's one of the more interesting superhero films, simply because the character of Eric is a little bit more... to me, he wasn't just a killing machine. He did have a sensitive side to him, and I did like that. He came across more as a tortured soul, rather than, as we've mentioned a few times in this podcast, like the Michael Myers or the Jason Voorhees type. He really was tortured and was just looking for peace. I do agree with Eric and Mike kind of poking fun at it, that it's a little bit, you know, over the top deep. But I really think everybody should give this movie a shot. And I think there's a lot of symbolism in it. There's a lot of stuff to kind of look at in different levels if you're into that too. So, yeah, I'm a go for this one, definitely.
He's a bad boy, but he cares.
Yes, yes.
Yep, for me, this is my second time seeing the film. And unlike the first time where I was, like, not happy to see it, and 5 minutes before the film... I was not happy to rewatch it because I didn't really like it the first time. Having watched it last night, this film is awesome. This is a great film. There's a lot of good stuff, a lot of good visuals. The acting's awesome. Brandon Lee is awesome. And even with the few flaws that we've discussed in the screenplay, again, it is a superhero film, and all superhero films seem to have these flaws because it's that superhero world. If you understand that, then those flaws aren't really that horrendous. So high recommend. Is a great film. Everybody should see it, and it's the 25th anniversary, perfect time to do so. Eric?
I'm the odd man out, coming in lowest on this movie. However, I still think it's a good movie. I disagree that it holds up against the test of time. I think some of the effects are really not that good looking at this point. And I had a couple of issues with the character development in the movie. I think it's a little bit elevated in people's opinion because of the tragedy of Brandon Lee's death during the shooting of the movie. However, that being said, I still think there's quite a bit to enjoy here. And it's definitely worth checking out on Netflix if you have not seen it yet. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out.
All right, very good. So, once again, this is 1994's The Crow, somewhat of a cult classic. A lot of critics liked it. It got a high rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and those aren't reevaluated ratings. Those are both ratings from the day it was released, as well as reevaluated ratings from newer reviewers. So, generally, folks have thought it was a pretty damn good film. Again, as Mike said, it's free on Netflix at this time, so definitely check it out. Though you can buy the deluxe DVD, anyway, for like $10, which has an extra disc and a bunch of extras and stuff. This is when those discs were filled with stuff from mainstream distribution companies, so people can check that out as well. And I guess that, with all that stated, I guess we can, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
Oh, wait. Does this mean that we have officially cleared the board of all of our Patreon films?
Yes. Until next month.
That's right. Until next month, though we do have Deathgasm Not released yet, though recorded. It has to be finished.
Recorded counts. That's not on.
Yeah, because that was the thing the Patreon subscriber wanted, was just that we recorded it. They didn't actually have any interest in hearing it.
Yeah, but that one, along with three other episodes that we do have, are being edited. Again, there was some minor issues with the recordings of those, not sound quality, just gaps between some of the talk. So those are being edited to be fixed and will be out soon enough. So that will include Deathgasm, along with three other topics. So now, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about The Crow. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.